inspiring the next generation of space enthusiasts and a new set of lunar wheels. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Marian Summerall, filling in for Brennan Byrne. In November, Sharon Hagel and her husband Mark Hagel became the first married couple to fly to space together twice. But while she was in space, she had a very special audience watching her launch. We'll speak with Space Kids Global founder Sharon Hagel about her trip to space and the eight kids chronicling her mission as junior reporters. Then, as NASA prepares a crew to walk on the moon with the Artemis missions, other modes of transportation are being developed. Just like the lunar roving vehicle from the Apollo missions, the Artemis missions need a new moon rover. We'll speak with space historian and journalist Robert Perlman about Intuitive Machines' lunar rover. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The nonprofit organization Space Kids Global aims to bring space to kids everywhere and get young people excited about careers in space. Space Kids Global founder and board chair Sharon Hagel returned to space once again, flying on Blue Origin's New Shepard capsule, but this time she had a special audience. Eight lucky kids from across the U.S. were selected for the Space Kids Global Press Squad contest, where they traveled to Florida to watch Hagel launch, tour Blue Origin, and be space reporters. I interviewed one of the winners, Zoe, on a previous episode. Here to talk about her trip to the edge of space and working with the young press squad is Sharon Hagel. Sharon, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you.
It's just such a wonderful organization, and I'm so excited to talk about it. But before we dive into Space Kids Global and the press squad you had attending your launch, I want to talk about the launch itself. This was your second trip to space. You were also joined by your husband, Mark Hagel. But did you feel nervous or as nervous the first time you went to space? I mean, tell me kind of about that buildup, you know, right before you're about to launch.
Well, I don't believe anybody's nervous. When I first signed up almost 20 years ago with Virgin Galactic, it was pretty much just, this may happen, it may not. And I figured, well, I'll worry about that when it gets closer. But as we did get closer, there was no anxiety, because when we go to astronaut training, we are trained all day long for 2 or 3 days. You start out at about 5 a.m. and you finish around 4:30, and it's trained over and over until it's cellular memory. So by the time we load up for the launch day, it's like, oh, we're back home.
That's a great way to look at it too. And I want to talk about you actually being up there. I know this time was a little bit different, but before we get into a little bit more detail about that, I really want to talk about that overview effect. Last time we had you on the show, I know we talked about it, and you were saying how it's one of the most incredible experiences, right, to see the Earth from a view that many people won't be able to see, right? So did the overview effect change for you this time? Was it the same?
The overview effect, in my opinion, never leaves you. Because regardless of how many times you go to space, you always want to go back. When you look at Earth and you see how fragile we are and how thin that atmosphere is, it takes your breath away. And I hear this over and over again, responsibility. But for me, you have a responsibility to come back to Earth and make it better.
So tell me about the press squad that was in attendance. For our listeners, we had Zoe on the show before, who was one of the members. I personally got to talk with her about the excitement of her going to Kennedy Space Center and seeing it launch. And they were able to really have their boots on the ground, right, while you were in the air, right?
You know, Zoe is an amazing young woman. She was representing Boys and Girls Clubs here in Orlando. The 1,100 entries that we received were from all 50 states across the country. And it was a random drawing. And the other 7 children were from all over the country, even rural areas. And most of them had never been to Florida or had gone to Kennedy Space Center. And our community here in Orlando just welcomed these kids with open arms. We had swag from Disney, from the Orlando City Soccer, Orlando Magic, Science, NASA, UCF. I think they had to get another suitcase to take all that swag home.
That's incredible. So they were just welcomed with open arms. So tell me a little bit about what they were doing, right, while you were actually in space, right, on your journey. What were they doing while you were there?
They had a full 3 days of activities. We had to make a corporate decision not to bring the children out to Van Horn, Texas, based on the fact that the space industry is known for having to be flexible, delays or scrubs.
And absolutely.
These kids were between the ages of 8 and 12. So what do you do out in the desert for 3 days if it's scrubbed? So by bringing them to KSC, we were able to really show them what the space industry is all about. They had a tour of ULA, which, wow, by the way, it was the icing on the cake. They got to see a SpaceX launch off the rooftop of ULA,
wow,
which was totally unscheduled.
So two launches, really, they got,
right,
to experience.
Then they had a tour of Blue Origin behind the scene for the new Glenn. And as you know, they're trying to push that launch before the end of this year, 2024.
Right.
So by going on the tour, they were able to interview rocket scientists, engineers, managers, to show them that there's space for everyone. And then they got to watch the live feed from the Mission Control Center at Blue Origin. Before all this happened, we had a NBC journalist come to the hotel and train them, because it takes a special way to interview people on camera. And so they had like an hour of training before all this started. And then to top it off, they got to go over to KSC for the day, go through the gateway. They were able to do the simulator, the Blue Origin capsule, which is very realistic. I've done it myself. And you get to feel the rush.
I also was on the Blue Origin capsule simulation, and it felt like I was going to space. I kind of was gripping my seat a little bit. I was a little scared because it really felt real. I'm sure that was just wonderful for them.
I was the first Blue Origin astronaut that got to take the simulator, and all the people that were in running that particular simulator was standing by, and they were really nervous because they didn't know how authentic it was going to be. And so when I came back out, I said, it's for real.
I felt like it was for real. I really did. It felt like I was going to space. Were you able to kind of hear their feedback as well from the whole experience? I can just imagine being that young, 8 to 12, and seeing not one, two launches behind the scenes, seeing the Kennedy Space Center. That's a life-changing experience, right?
I was told, because I was doing something else at,
right,
the time.
you were a little busy leaving the planet.
But I was told that when the booster was coming back to Earth and they felt that sonic boom, that they thought we were back on Earth and they started clapping. And it was explained that, no, that's the capsule that's falling 65 miles before the parachutes open, that we were in the capsule. And it was the first time that they saw that perspective, that they knew people in the capsule that was coming back to Earth. They hadn't really thought from that perspective. And then they got concerned about, when's the parachutes going to open?
That's so interesting to think about, right? You always think about astronauts are launching. Well, wait, they're coming back.
Well, and to know two people, that changes your whole perspective.
Right. So for you personally, I know that, like we said, you were a little busy, right? You were off the planet. But how did this whole experience make you feel, knowing that these kids were able to have this experience, that they made connections with you? When I spoke with Zoe, she was saying how excited she was to hear from you. I mean, just how do you feel? The goal that we've talked about for a long time, it happened.
This took about 3 years to plan the Space Kids Press Squad. There were a lot of logistics bringing these children in from all over the country. The timing of all of their flights landing, it was challenging. But saying all that and seeing what change it's made on their lives is just overwhelming. It's very emotional because these kids, that experience has changed them. We talk about Zoe, and she always said she loves cooking, but now all of a sudden she's thinking about cooking for space food.
We've talked about it before, that space is for everyone. That's a common thing that you and I have discussed, and that you and Brendan have discussed on the show. Is that the main goal from this, right? To get kids excited about space. Do you think that you got to kind of see that really come alive, that notion that space is for everyone and getting kids excited about space?
Absolutely. Every hands-on project we have, it really opens doors, not only to show them the different careers, but giving them hope. I truly believe that if you can see it, you can do it. And by that, I mean, we've all been in class in a challenging situation and you think, well, maybe I can't do that. But then you see your girlfriend over there doing it and you go, well, if she can do it, I can do it. And I think that's a lot that goes into the thought process for these children.
And I want to go back to your experience itself. You know, I know that this journey was a little bit different for you, right? Not only were you able to just glance out of the window and see our Earth, you were also participating in some science experiments, right?
This time we wanted to do something that we could help space companies gather data. And so we were wearing the bio button from L-2 all the way through the launch until we got back to Earth. And what this does, it records all your vitals. So I'm particularly curious about when we were climbing up the 7 stories, the tower up to the gantry, we were starting out at about 4,000 feet elevation. So obviously, being here in Orlando, by the time I got to the gantry, I was really sucking oxygen. So I can't wait to see those recordings. And then we were asked to do, for NASA, tying rope in zero gravity.
Okay.
Because when astronauts get in zero gravity on other planets like the moon or in space travel, they need to tie down the payloads and there's no tension on their rope. So you have to figure out how to tie the rope and secure both ends. It was really interesting, especially in zero gravity.
Yeah. How was tying the rope in zero gravity? Did you kind of find it a little difficult?
Yes and no. Took me a little while to figure out you need tension on the rope and then you can tie it.
That's so interesting. And aside from the science too, you and your husband, Mark Hagel, set a record and you were the first married couple in history to return to space.
Well, I give Mark full credit. He always takes me out of my comfort zone, regardless of what extreme things we've done over our journey over the last 30 years. It's great to have your partner sitting behind you and the two of you looking out the window from space and pointing out the different locations on Earth, and then to experience it and stay in the moment together. That's what's so difficult, because your adrenaline's running so high that on our original flight, it was hard to stay in the moment. There was so much going on. And so this time it gave us another opportunity to look back and start remembering. But it's always great when you get back to Earth that you have somebody that experienced this with you, because you can be sitting there and go, oh, remember when so-and-so happened? Or when I had Saba, the little plush toy, the zero-G tracker with me, and I let it go and it started floating away and then I couldn't get it. And so it was time to get back in our seats. So we just had to let everything fall in the capsule. So then once we landed, I had to go around and find out where Saba ended up.
For our listeners who maybe don't know who Saba is, and if you don't know who Saba is, please go look up a picture of Saba. Can you tell us who Saba is?
Saba is our Saba the space dog. He's accompanied me for 15 and a half years. He's gone to all the schools, all the conventions, space company speaking engagements. Saba's always there, and Blue Origin was so kind enough to make him a spacesuit to match ours. So he wears his spacesuit when we go and do these speaking engagements.
And you were able to bring, just so I understand, a little mini version plush of him to space. That is just adorable. Sharon Hagel is the founder and board chair of Space Kids Global. Sharon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure being here with you.
Still to come, driving on the moon.
This rover is designed so that the astronauts can drive it, the astronauts can be in the vehicle, and the controllers back at Intuitive Machines can drive it for them, or there could be no humans on the moon at the time, and Intuitive Machines can drive it around using the robotic arm mounted on its back to continue performing science.
A look at Intuitive Machines Moon Racer. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA is aiming to launch humans in 2027 to explore the moon's South Pole region as part of the Artemis missions. But once the crew lands on the moon, how will they travel around? During the Apollo missions in the 70s, the lunar roving vehicle was used.
It's working, my friend. Beautiful. In overall performance, the LRV more than met its standards. During a total of 3 hours and 2 minutes of stop-and-go driving on the moon, the vehicle traveled a total of 25 kilometers, about 15 statute miles.
But now, over 50 years later, NASA has selected Intuitive Machines, Lunar Outpost, and Venturi Astrolab to create vehicles for future Artemis missions so the crew can cruise along the lunar surface and conduct scientific research. But not only are these companies preparing for the moon missions, these vehicles could be models for future missions to Mars. In Houston, Texas, Intuitive Machines unveiled its lunar rover called Moonracer, and Robert Perlman, the founder and editor of CollectSpace.com, a journalist and historian, was able to witness the vehicle and its capabilities. He joins us now to talk about this Moonmobile. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I know you've done some pretty interesting reporting on something called Moonracer. Looking at this vehicle from Intuitive Machines, it really looks like a go-kart, in my opinion. But you were also there at the unveiling of Moonracer. So can we talk a little bit about how that day went and what it was like?
I was happy to be invited to come over to Space Center Houston, the official visitor center for NASA's Johnson Space Center here in Houston, Texas, to get a first look at Intuitive Machines Moonracer. And just to get it out of the way, RACER is actually an acronym for Reusable Autonomous Crewed Exploration Rover, but we'll be calling it RACER from this point forward. And it is what it sounds like. It is a moon rover. It is posing to be the next generation moon buggy after the Apollo Lunar Roving Vehicle, or Apollo Lunar Rover, that three missions took to the moon in the 1970s. And so its intention is to enable astronauts to be able to drive around further from their landing site than they'd be able to get while walking, and enable them to pick up and drop off science experiments, pick up moon rocks, and bring them back to where their base is.
It can accommodate astronauts and drive them, but it also can carry a lot of cargo. I read something like 882 pounds and can pull over almost 1,800 pounds. What is that function for? I mean, what are the astronauts going to be pulling with this thing?
Well, there is an intention to bring science experiments to deploy, also possibly drills to be able to dig into the lunar surface to find lunar ice, because they're going to be targeting the South Pole and the permanently shadowed craters at the South Pole looking for water ice. But the unique thing about this rover is the Apollo Lunar Rover had to have a driver. This rover is designed so that the astronauts can drive it. The astronauts can be in the vehicle and the controllers back at Intuitive Machines can drive it for them, or there could be no humans on the moon at the time and Intuitive Machines can drive it around using the robotic arm mounted on its back to continue performing science. What they can do is they can tell the rover, just like what we do with the Mars rovers, they can tell the Moonracer, hey, we want you to go over to that rock over there and go collect it. And presuming there's no big obstacles in the way that would prevent it from doing so, it can drive itself over there and do that autonomously. Or a driver on Earth can just take manual control and drive it him or herself to that location, or an astronaut on the moon can do the same.
Now, Robert, as a fellow space enthusiast, I'm sure you were excited to see when they tested this out when you were there. Tell me about what that was like. This obviously is a very advanced piece of technology. Just tell me a little bit about what was going through your head and kind of what you saw from the crowd that was there.
I would say there were about 100 people there. This wasn't open to the public, but it was NASA officials and industry partners who are working with Intuitive Machines to build this rover. The rover that we saw was the second rover that they built. They built a static version first that is at Johnson Space Center, has been there since September, that is being put through what's called human-in-the-loop tests by putting real astronauts into this mock-up to see what works, what doesn't work, you know, in terms of ergonomics and getting in and out of the rover. Can you easily get in and out if you're in a spacesuit? And just refining the design. The version that we saw was the first fully electric moving mock-up that a week after I saw it was going to be shipped out to Arizona and put into tests in the desert near Meteor Crater find conditions that are similar to on the moon so they could demonstrate to NASA that this could drive over rocks, it can perform the autonomous and manually driven features that it has been designed to do, and that it would be sufficient to work on the moon. This electric vehicle was built for Intuitive Machines by Roush, which is a high-performance car manufacturer. They actually do mostly race cars.
So that's why it looks like a Mario Kart car to me sometimes.
So this is sort of a cross between the lunar rover of the 70s with either a Mario Kart. I likened it in our story to a souped-up golf cart. Now, I did ask some questions along those lines, because there were some questions about its design. There's no rain on the moon, so the way this rover looks, it has a roof, and you'd wonder, well, why do you need a roof over your head if there's no, you know, precipitation, or heck, there's no air? So why do you need a roof over your head? Well, that roof actually is not so much for the astronauts themselves, but it's a storage facility and a mount. It's where they have antennas of every type of communication we have, from laser to radio to high band and low band bandwidth, S band, and meant to be able to connect any way that NASA can to control it. And then that also becomes a storage location for equipment that the astronauts may need. It also has somewhat of a roll cage. This can drive on a surface up to, I believe, 30 degrees inclination. But if it does happen to roll, the astronauts would be safe inside. And yes, it, unlike the Apollo lunar rover, it does have seat belts, but it'll be up to the astronaut whether they want to wear them or not.
I'm looking at a picture of Moon Racer, and I know for a lot of people that first moon rover, right? That Apollo moon rover, it's really a sign of our history. So do you think that this Moon Racer will kind of be that next symbol for us as we explore the moon?
Well, the Apollo lunar rover was also fully electric. It ran off of batteries. But the big difference is that once those batteries died, they didn't have a way to recharge them. This new moon rover and two others that are being designed by two other companies, and NASA's going to select down to at least one of them to be used on the moon, they are designed, as is the entire Artemis program, to be what NASA calls sustainable, so that we're not just going there to plant flags and put down footprints and then leave, but this time stay there. Of course, we're somewhat in a flux right now in terms of whether that goal will stay that goal, because we're in the process of changing presidents, and with every new administration comes some space policy differences. So we'll have to wait to see how much of this plays out going forward. But right now, NASA has its orders, and that is including landing this, at least one of the rovers, on the moon. And so, yes, it needed solar panels to be able to recharge. And I think this will become a model how we do short distance exploration, because at the same time, we have partnered with Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, their contribution to the Artemis program in return for having their astronauts have access to the lunar surface through our vehicles, is to build a pressurized moon rover. So this is open to the vacuum space. And so the Moon Racer is meant for short drives where you jump in and out and get and collect samples. But the pressurized rover will be its own base, in a sense, on wheels. The astronauts will not only be able to take drives out to do science experiments and to deploy equipment and to collect moon rocks, but they can stay in that vehicle for days on end because it'll carry its own living facilities. And so I think between those two vehicles, it will show that we've expanded our transportation options on the moon. And then essentially that is what we will do when we get to Mars.
That was going to be my next question, is that would be a huge game changer, right? Because we would be able, in theory, to put humans on Mars in that pressurized system, right?
These rovers are a model of what potentially could be deployed on Mars. There'd be differences. There's a difference in gravity. There'd probably be more of a desire to have a pressurized rover than an unpressurized rover. But there, you could use an unpressurized rover on Mars as well, as where and wear spacesuits in the process. The big difference of getting to Mars and using a human-driven rover would be comparing it with the rovers that we've sent there to date. So Curiosity and Perseverance, our latest two that are still exploring Mars right now, they do a tremendous amount of work and have covered a great amount of distance. But if you take a look at their entire mission and combine both of them, everything they've done, a human on a human-driven rover could perform all the tasks they've done within the period of probably a day or two. And so There's just only so much you can do with a robotic-driven rover that has to take its instructions in the morning and then and go off on its own. It has to travel a lot slower, at least now, and operate at a much more careful pace than humans can. And there's an addition to that, the benefit of a human can look ahead and not just have instructions on from mission control what they're supposed to do, but they might look out, you know, from the window or through the, you know, just the open rover and see a more interesting target and go over there and explore it, where the rover can't do that. The rover has to take photos and then send them back to Earth and wait for someone on Earth to analyze those photos and then see the more interesting target and then resend instructions and start again. Whereas a human can just see, oh, well, let's go over that horizon and then head off in that direction. And so putting humans on Mars will redefine the way that we explore that planet. We have to be careful right now because we have to make the choice. Once you put humans on Mars, the search for indigenous life on Mars becomes a lot more difficult because no matter how tight the spacesuit, no matter how tight pressurized the rover, we will be leaking human DNA onto the surface. And so you want to be sure that the life you find isn't something that we brought there versus something that emerged from there. There'll be those discussions before we go, but that's the ultimate goal of the Artemis program. That's the ultimate goal of the Moon Racer and everything that we're doing now, is to learn on the moon how to operate vehicles and bases and just learn how to operate astronaut crews before going off to Mars that is 6 months away and has communication delays up to 40 minutes round trip and will require us to be much more autonomous on our own working on Mars versus how we operate, let's say, the International Space Station today, which is where mission control is always in the loop.
Fascinating. From the moon to Mars. And Robert, thank you so much for joining us. Robert Perlman is the founder and editor of CollectSpace.com, a space history website. Robert, thank you so much for coming back on the show to talk all about Moon Racer and what's in store for the future of Artemis and Mars missions.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTUI Space. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. We're at AWTUI@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our host is Brennan Byrne. Our producer is me, Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Marion Summerall. Thanks for listening.